Well, as I said, we're going to interrupt our studies in Romans for a few weeks to examine in particular the Lord's Prayer and its distinctives. Now, it is found in both the Gospel of Matthew and in the Gospel of Luke. Luke introduces it in a different way than does Matthew, so let's begin by first looking at how it is given to us in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew chapter 6, verse 7, and then we'll turn over and look at Luke chapter 11. And when you pray, this is Jesus speaking, verse 5, I'm sorry, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners that they may be seen by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. And then in Luke's Gospel, listen to how Luke introduces this. Chapter 11, verse 1. Now, Jesus was praying in a certain place, and when He finished, one of His disciples said to Him, Lord, teach us to pray as John taught his disciples to pray. The Lord's Prayer, as it's popularly known, is not a prayer that the Lord Jesus Himself prayed. He had no need to ask for forgiveness. It is a prayer, rather, for His disciples. And what is interesting as you look at this prayer is He doesn't say to us, pray these exact words, but rather pray in this manner. Now, Luke tells us that Jesus frequently was in prayer. And you can read through the Synoptic Gospels where Jesus withdrew into prayer. This was something His disciples noticed. And on this occasion, after Jesus had come out of a season of prayer, one of His disciples has a request. And it's not, Lord, teach us how to do miracles like You do. We would like to be able to turn water into wine. We would like to be able to walk on stormy seas and still the storms. We would like to be able to raise the dead. It's nothing like that. They were impressed with the fact that prayer was something that He valued and took a great deal of time with. And so they say, this one disciple, just as John has taught his disciples to pray, would you teach us likewise how to pray? And it's interesting that the first thing He does is to tell them how not to do it. Now, that is very helpful. If you've ever had the experience of trying to fix something and it's new to you, having the advice of someone who's been down that road before to tell you, now look, when you start to do this, don't do it this way or you will later regret it. And interestingly, Jesus begins the same thing. And He draws one illustration from Jewish society, to which all the disciples were conversant, and He draws one from the pagan or the Gentile society. In the first case, it was obvious to the disciples as well that it was a common practice among the Jews to have public prayers that were quite ostentatious. And so Jesus says specifically, you must not be like, and He calls them hypocrites. Now that word hypocrite has come over to us to imply that someone is doing something insincerely, or it's a facade. But actually the word, which is a derivative from the very Greek word, hypokritos, referred to someone who was a stage actor and who would put on a mask to hide themselves. And so the word was originally used of someone who was pretending to be something they're really not. It really doesn't have the concept of insincerity involved. It's like an actor playing a role. I remember watching on television the life of Bing Crosby. And he played a Roman Catholic priest in Boys Town. Most of you have seen the movie. And he was most uncomfortable being cast as a religious person because he confessed that he wasn't a religious person at all. In fact, he was troubled over the fact that he was quite involved in horse racing. And a Roman Catholic priest had to convince him that he could play the role with his conscience not being unduly bothered by the fact that he really wasn't a Roman Catholic priest. He was only pretending to be one. Well, that's what a hypocritos was. And Jesus says, don't be like that. And what are they doing? He says there is a public display of piety. They love to be seen of men. It was a sign of pride that they would labor long in their prayers in a public place for the purpose of being thought to be pious. And pretentious piety is the worst kind. It's the Uriah Heep. How many of you know who that character is? Anyone know who Uriah Heep is? No? Does anyone not know who Uriah Heep is? Of course you do. Charles Dickens' favorite character, who was a pretentious minister who would pretend to be pious in order to get something, sympathy or whatever. And people use religion to convince people that they are pious. And pretentious piety is the kind that, as the first word would suggest, is pretentious. And Jesus says they love to be seen. Now, he quickly adds, before getting to the second way of not praying, that prayer is primarily to be something that you do privately. Now, he's not condemning public prayer per se, because we're going to read in the book of Acts that there was numerous times that the church was involved in public prayer. But he's saying that these individuals who are praying in the synagogue or on the street corners are doing it only for the sake of how people perceive them. And he says they have their reward, meaning people think they're religious. That's as far as their prayers got them. But when you pray, go into your room, and Jesus says, pray so that you're not observed. And this is basically how prayer is deemed to be that which expresses dependence upon God. You see, God is not impressed with our piety. God is not impressed even with our religious convictions that bring us to prayer. What he is impressed with is that we approach him in the right frame. That is, we're not doing this because other people will think of us as being devout, but we're expressing our dependence. And so the first thing is, our prayers are not to be an ostentatious display of our own religiosity to impress others. I'm uncomfortable in public prayer. I'll just be candid with you. I try to avoid preaching a mini sermon when I pray the pastoral prayer, as if I'm informing you of something that God needs to be told as well. Rather, public prayer is to be something in which you are actually listening in on prayer that I would pray even if you weren't here. That's how it should be done. But now the second thing that Jesus says our prayer is not to be characterized is the way of the Gentile, and he uses the word pagan. Now, if there's any way that we can offend people's religious sensitivities today is to suggest that somebody's religious views, no matter how sincerely held, are wrong. It's just the nature of the beast in our times of political correctness that we seem to ascribe that every person's religious views has validity just because they hold them. And Jesus said it's not the case. In the case of the Jews, public ostentatious prayers did no good whatsoever. In the case of the Gentile world, the Jew, the pagan world, he likewise says, do not heap up empty phrases. Now, this is a rather interesting word, and I spell it out for you in the notes. It's a word like vain repetition. And what it really suggested was a form of repetitious stuttering. In fact, the word in its root meant to stutter. You know, someone who stutters, you know, Porky Pig. And yet there was in the pagan world, the notion that words had some kind of magical charm about them. You know, like abracadabra. If you've read The Hobbit, in the situation where Gandalf is trying to remember the words that would cause this door to open, and he's sitting there and going through all these phrases because he has to come up with the right charm in order to get the response. And in the Gentile world, it was believed that by using a certain phrase, like that in and of itself had the power to maneuver or manipulate God. Jesus says, don't be like that. They think, now notice how this is put, that by their many words, God will be heard. You have a classic example of this in the Old Testament on Mount Carmel when there is the confrontation between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And you remember the scene that was given there, that they were going to have who is really God is the God who answered by fire. And so they have two altars, and the prophets of Baal begin by calling upon Baal to answer them. And they describe the scene as where they start to cut themselves and to bleed and to yell and to scream repetitiously. And Elijah is mocking them, scream louder. Maybe he's asleep or he's off relieving himself. He's making fun of the impotency of their God Baal. And that is what Jesus is referring to, is people who think that by phrases repeated over and over again, that somehow there is the power of a positive confession. Do you know that that's actually a popular movement within Christianity? It's part of the prosperity gospel. Name it and claim it. That there is power in your words. And you can use these words as a key to unlock God's promises. Jesus explicitly condemns that kind of prayer. Prayer is to be something that we gather just from these two passages, is to be done in private. Although public prayer is not condemned as such, it's ostentatious prayer. But it is also thoughtful prayer, which means the Lord's Prayer could be abused. If you think by reciting the Lord's Prayer repetitiously that somehow is going to cause God to respond, then you are violating the very prohibitions that He laid down before you say the Lord's Prayer. This past week, we had the horrible scene in Boston. How many times can you remember listening to people commenting on this, whether it was the president or a news commentator? Our prayers and thoughts are with those who suffered. Our prayers and thoughts. As if, by the virtue of our being caring and compassionate, our prayers somehow had some sort of charm about them. They don't. We may empathize with people when they suffer. We may grieve with them as they suffer. But distinctively Christian prayer has this thoughtfulness about it, in which it covers the range of what it is we as sinners must do when coming into the presence of a holy God. And that is perhaps the biggest reason that most people have a deficient understanding of prayer, is they begin by thinking of God as some kind of celestial Santa Claus or magician who basically is waiting like a bellhop for them to call upon Him. The other thing I want you to notice about what Jesus says in this Lord's Prayer is He doesn't say, pray these words. I'm under the impression in studying this passage that Jesus is giving us what R.C. Sproul has referred to as transferable principles, and that the pattern that we find here, in which the elements of prayer are broken down so that we, first of all, seek first the glory of God, and we look at how the petitions highlight that His name be sanctified and hallowed, that His will, not our will, be done. There is the admission of the need for forgiveness as well as the need to forgive others. Listen, as we say this prayer, all of us ought to have a serious reflection on how far short we fall when we say things like, "and forgive us our debts," or, as it's sometimes translated, "our trespasses." And as we unpack that phrase, we'll see that it's talking about the fact that we have violated the law of God and stand in need of forgiveness, but how it's linked to, and those who have trespassed against us. There comes the hard part. Listen, I can tell you as a person who has experienced this, genuinely forgiving someone who has wronged you, slandered your name, insulted your reputation, or worse, it's not easy. It is a sign of the grace of God that we can forgive people who've done that. And I will tell you something else. Any Christian prayer that does not have at some point an acknowledgement of the need for forgiveness is an indication of a graceless heart. You look at the prayers that, when we're going to examine and compare them, you look at the prayers, for example, of the Pharisee who went down to the temple. There is no acknowledgement of the man's culpability or guilt before God at all, none at all. It's missing. It's absent. He doesn't see himself as a sinner needing forgiveness, in contrast to the publican, who that's what he's primarily aware of, is how far short he falls. And it all begins with how each one of them sees their relationship to God, first and foremost. So when we recite the Lord's Prayer, and R.C. Sproul has a series on the Lord's Prayer, which I've been listening to, and he uses the illustration of someone who is taught to play the piano, learning the repetitious scales, perhaps with any musical instrument. Repetition, 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 repetition. And he gives the illustration of a fellow who had his piano teacher, and he said to him, after having to go through the scale for the umpteenth hundred time, "Look, I'm sick and tired of this. I want to be able to play the piano like Van Cliburn. Can I please get on with it?" And the instructor was wise and said, "I cannot guarantee you that you will ever play the piano like Van Cliburn did or does. But I will assure you that he practiced the scales as much as you're going to, whether or not you ever become that good." And isn't that the case with so many things? Like when you learned your multiplication tables, at times it may have seemed to be rather, you know, boring that you learn automatically without even having to figure what 7 plus 7 was, 7 times 7. And you learn this in terms of the English grammar, how to recognize vowels, and some of it seems memorizing things by rote. If you learn a language like Latin or Greek, you'll have to study syntax, and you'll have to learn to stand how to parse nouns and verbs and parts of speech, and it seems so boring. I've got to learn all this stuff by rote. Catechism. Going through the Westminster Catechism, the Shorter Catechism, or the Heidelberg Catechism. And eventually there comes a time when this starts to ferment, and it starts to gel, and there start to be some cohesiveness. I know when you start to study a language, the excitement that comes when down the road, after all that laborious rote memorization, suddenly you can look at a word and instantly recognize the tense, the mode, the mood. You can, all that happens like that, but it didn't take place unless there had been this laborious thing. Same thing with prayer. Pray in this manner. And there we have a formula, which is to characterize our prayer. And Christian prayer is to be distinctively patterned after what the Lord's Prayer is. So even though we say it by rote, here's the wonderful thing about it. All of you should have memorized the Lord's Prayer by now. We say it every week and have been doing it for how long? Years? Here's a challenge to you. You've had a sleepless night. I've noticed something as I get older. I get plagued by insomnia from time to time. I really do. I like to go out into the desert frequently when the weather allows, just by myself, and take the radio and put on a classical musical station, or if the D-backs are on, I'll listen to the D-back game, and I'll take a book. In fact, I've been reading Herman Vitsius on the Lord's Prayer. And from time to time, I'll pause from reading and I'll recite the Lord's Prayer, and then I will start to amplify each phrase. My Father, which art in heaven. As Paul tells us in Ephesians, praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in heavenly places. And rehearsing the blessings of salvation and what they entail. Hallowed be thy name. The great and glorious God who has stooped to deal with me as a sinner. May I be able to echo the refrain of the heavenly host. Worthy is the Lamb who is slain to receive power and honor and glory. See, you can unpack the particular phrases from the Lord's Prayer and plug in other scriptures that emphasize these distinctive truths. And though that is a marvelous way to do what the psalmist does. You know, the Psalms are basically the church's prayer book. It really is. The Psalms are just laden with prayers. And the psalmist says how he loves to meditate. And as he does it, he is praying. Meditation is a form of prayer. Now, you have down through the history of the church, particularly in the Roman Catholic tradition, books on spiritual exercises, and some of them can be profitable. But spiritual exercises are disciplines that we inculcate into our lives. It was said of Martin Luther that he prayed 2 hours a day. Now, you think of how enormously busy this man was. All the things that were clamoring for his attention. And yet he said, if I did not pray 2 hours a day, the devil had me before noon. And I go, whoa, that's heavy. I can't handle this. How can you do that? He said, I found that I could accomplish more by praying than I could by not. So instead of restricting prayer to that, let's get through with this and get on with the rest of the day, Luther began the day absorbed in prayer. Now, he doesn't go into a lot of detail as to all that went into that, other than to suggest to us that the key to his fruitfulness was the fact that prayer was a priority with him. So I'm encouraging you to do the same. Begin your day by reciting the Lord's Prayer and do as I suggested. Amplify each phrase based upon the rest of the scriptures. Charles Haddon Spurgeon said it best. The man that prays well is someone who has studied his Bible well. And it is the Bible that informs our prayers. It is the Bible that informs. Listen, you're not going to come to an adequate understanding of who God is based on popular culture. And unfortunately, our culture communicates to us massive messages about how we see ourselves, about how we see God. And we have no way of filtering that except Scripture. That's it. Only the Bible can filter out all the garbage that the world tries to communicate to us. And so I suggest to you that you begin your day by praying the Lord's Prayer as you read the Bible and meditate upon the attributes of God. Now, we have an opportunity this morning to reflect and meditate upon the Lord's body and blood. And as the elders and deacons come forward now,